Blog Talk Radio.
Finally, we got back on. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. We had a bit of a snafu this morning, and I'm so glad you guys all came back because for some reason I kept getting a strange message, and then the show just went off. So, Andre, good morning. You saved the day. With me are my friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodetas, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Cowan. I'm so glad you did it, guys. I could not get back on, so bravo.
I don't know
you
what the deal was. Yeah, it may have been a combination of us doing two things at once. I don't know whether we had two shows scheduled, but in any event, we're okay now.
Yeah,
we're good. This
okay,
one will,
we're okay.
This one will go the duration. You can even go a full hour and 20 minutes, or not hour
okay.
and 20 minutes,
okay.
2 hours.
2 hours,
120
yeah.
minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
120,
all right.
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we persevered. And
indeed.
Our friends are all on board. Good to see you guys. And Don,
sort of
thanks for calling back in, buddy.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Marvin?
Part
yeah.
Part of the course on this strange world.
Well, we've only done this for 13 years. You think we after
yeah.
a while, but, you know. But that's, you know, my old friend Andre Traversi used to say, it's live radio, folks. This is the kind of thing that happens. And
yeah.
I was such a fan of live radio. So sometimes you get a snafu. And they kept telling me when I was trying to call back, we are experiencing system problems. Well, I think that's just a generic message they give you when you can't get your show to start.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice. Yeah.
We're here. I want to do a shout out for Juneteenth. Yay. What a wonderful thing that is, that finally, you know, we celebrate with a holiday, the end of slavery. And that's just thrilling
yeah.
to me. It's thrilling.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody wants to be a slave. Let's face it, I don't. And I know none of you do. And I can't imagine there's any human being any one of God's children in the universe of universes that would think that that's a desirable place to be. So I think it's wholly appropriate that we celebrate the end of slavery in America and make it a holiday. So yay. And I wanted to share a quote in that vein, which is a favorite from the Jesus Papers. And I had it all called up, but the snafu kind of messed that up.
while you're looking for it, Paula, I just kind of make the observation that even here in this country, we are still dealing with the after effects on all of the complications of our history of slavery. And I mean, we're far from the situation we should be in and eventually will be in terms of equality of opportunity and really supporting all human beings, regardless of their ethnicity or racial background or religious background, supporting everyone in moving forward in the quest for happiness and fulfillment in life. And the other thing is, slavery is alive and well in many parts of our world, you know. So it's just it's symptomatic of this strange situation that we're in on our planet, where, you know, parts of our societies are advanced and other parts are incredibly regressed still and savage and barbaric. So, you know, we've got it's quite a mixture on this world.
Yes, it is. Here's the quote, and this is, of course, from Jesus and his lecture from paper 134. He says, if one man craves freedom, liberty, he must remember that all other men long for the same freedom. Groups of such liberty-loving mortals cannot live together in peace without becoming subservient to such laws, rules, and regulations as will grant each person the same degree of freedom, while at the same time safeguarding an equal degree of freedom for all of his fellow mortals. If one man is to be absolutely free, then another man must become an absolute slave. And the relative nature of freedom is true, socially, economically, and politically. Freedom is the gift of civilization, made possible by the enforcement of law. I love that statement, and I've pondered it. I can't tell you how many times I've pondered that statement, because it's intriguing, isn't it? If one man is to be absolutely free, then another must become an absolute slave. And I think about, you know, Lucifer's folly of unbridled self-liberty and unmitigated selfishness. And, you know, it just strikes me as being so definitive that we create, if we all love freedom, and we do, we create freedom with laws. And each person relinquishes some freedom so that others can also be free. Because nobody can do whatever they want. Everybody has to contribute, you know, sacrifice something for the greater good. That's the way I understand it. You guys probably get other things out of it too, but.
Yeah, well, law is the key, certainly, to creating fairness. Fairness and predictability and knowing how things can work, you know, having at least some kind of a frame within which constructive relationships can be created and progress for all can conceivably be achieved. It's just that there's always this impulse to take unfair advantage of others. If you can somehow even trick someone into doing work for you, maybe they don't, you know what I mean? I guess what I'm saying is we have to keep our eyes open going forward, because we could find, you know, sort of new kinds of slavery, you know, maybe like high-tech slavery of some kind, you know what I mean, that isn't necessarily, won't look like the slavery of the 1800s. It might have a completely different appearance. So we need to watch out for anything that usurps our sovereignty. You know, it's interesting in those Urmia lectures how Jesus talks about sovereignty. You know, that's one of the main messages he's trying to put forward there. You know, there's the sovereignty of the individual and the sovereignty of God. And all the intervening levels somehow have to be coordinated with this, the individual level and the level of the whole. And to be, as an individual, taking initiative and voluntarily serving the whole is a great feeling. And that's kind of, I think, an evolutionary step that comes after self-serving, is this desire to serve the whole, to be part of something bigger than yourself. And that's, you know,
right.
That's where the real spiritual satisfactions come in, and where we can really have a tangible vision of the future that's good for everyone. So that, you know, that's a ragged transition from self-serving to serving the whole voluntarily, you know, to have that attitude born within oneself, where you see the
right.
Wisdom of that. Part of what maybe we should, you know, we're kind of celebrating today is even maybe a glimpse of that possibility.
Yeah. Is someone else, was that you, Marvin? Hello?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, I thought you maybe wanted to make a comment. I wanted to add another quote onto the first one, because someone suggested, actually it was Crystalline, our old producer, suggested that we do a shout-out for Juneteenth, because today is Juneteenth, and we reached this marvelous bipartisan agreement that it should be a holiday, which that in itself is a reason to celebrate, if you ask me. But and so I wanted to do that. And I throw it out there, if any of our friends on the board like to call in and celebrate Juneteenth just for a moment before we start our study, I invite you to do that. Go ahead and call us at 646-716-8158 and press your one key, and we'll know you have something to share. But here's another quote that always strikes me about this matter. And this is from paper 173, and it's Midware commentary on Jesus cleansing the temple. It's 173.111. The cleansing of the temple discloses the master's attitude toward commercializing the practices of religion, as well as his detestation of all forms of unfairness, going on what you said, Chuck, and profiteering at the expense of the poor and the unlearned. This episode also demonstrates that Jesus did not look with approval upon the refusal to employ force to protect the majority of any given human group against the unfair and enslaving practices of unjust minorities who may be able to entrench themselves behind political, financial, or ecclesiastical power. Shrewd, wicked, and designing men are not to be permitted to organize themselves for the exploitation and oppression of those who, because of their idealism, are not disposed to resort to force for self-protection or for the furtherance of their laudable life projects. So I don't know how on earth, you know, whoever they're not to be allowed, who's going to stop them? I don't know that part of it. But, you know, I mean, that's always the challenge, right? That has always been the challenge. Who's going
right.
to stop that from happening?
Right.
But,
there's a couple of lines,
you know,
in paper 69, I think, that are interestingly relevant here as well. I don't know if they provide any clues to your question, but in paper 69, part 8 is about slavery. And just jumping down to the 9th paragraph, they say that, let's see. Paragraph 8 is just the last line there. They say, slavery creates an organization of culture and social achievement, but soon insidiously attacks society internally as the gravest of all destructive social maladies. And then in paragraph 10, I think there's just one line there that's also very interesting. They say, today, men and women, of course, are not social slaves, but thousands, when they say thousands, maybe it should be millions. Anyway, but thousands allow ambition to enslave them to debt. Involuntary slavery has given way to a new and improved form of modified industrial servitude.
Huh.
So that's kind of the thing that I was thinking of, that we have to be on the lookout for.
Right, that we don't become...
Won't be working in cotton fields, but it might be working in some, other kind of employment that is not conducted fairly. Or
I
that
agree,
you find yourself.
Chuck.
The thing about slavery to debt is a very interesting thing for the book to point out, I think.
Yeah. And, of course, we can...
If anybody's ever experienced that...
It is for me.
Yeah.
I think all of us, because you have to go into debt to do anything, pretty much. Buy a car, a house. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, you asked me if I had a comment. I actually was on mute, but I was thinking something. So I think you picked up on something, Paula. What was occurring to me is really quite related to the strand of conversation we're having right now. And that is, one way of understanding this is that there are two levels. One is the spiritual level, and then there's the level of structure and political structure and the evolution of law and societal structures. And it's interesting in the Urmia lectures, Jesus delivered two set of lectures. One is spiritual or religious sovereignty and the relations among the religions and the spiritual values as they work out in our lives. And the other level is political sovereignty or power, which relates to structure and law. What I'm struck by is we're being called to a spiritual ideal, and actually the highest expression of that ideal is the parent-child relationship. The kind of devotion and compassion we should be having for each other is the kind of devotion for the welfare of an immature being, a developing, growing being that a really perfect, loving parent has, right? We should have a kind of caring for another person's well-being and their opportunities and their ability to thrive and find happiness and satisfaction as a really loving, devoted parent has for their child. And we should have that for each other. That should color our sister-brother relationships. And that's the ideal. And yet we live on this crazy patch-quilt world, which is evolving in a very erratic way. And we won't be having that kind of motivation govern our social relations for a long time. It's a mixture of higher and lower. And in the interim, there are these other structures that are legal and political, which Chuck's passage, I think, was alluding to. That's what we have to depend on to keep vicious minorities and self-centered minorities from dominating people's lives, And so in the interim, as we evolve, you've got to have these legal structures, these law structures that, will sort of hold things and allow us to move forward. So it's interesting that it happens on both levels, the spiritual level and the political or power level. Structural level.
Right. And it's something
and kind of almost bridging between those two or integrating those two are principles that can be discovered and articulated and made real in practice. It's like law sort of creates rules, which is kind of the ground rules, you know, the foundation. Okay, we can all agree to these rules, but then how do we build on top of the rules? And I think that's where principles come in.
Right.
So this idea of offering voluntary service to the good of the whole is a principle that people can conceivably grasp and act on, you know, as a guiding influence in terms of how they organize their efforts and contribute to society. So, I mean, that's just one example, but I think there could be others, too.
Mm-hmm.
That could be put in place and agreed on, but it's not law. It's sort of it's almost like a meta-law. It assumes obedience to the law and then provides a path forward that can organize effort in a positive direction. So anyway, I think that's it's something I think about a lot because of my experiences with Burning Man, which I talked about, but that, you know, it's governed by principles, or at least
right.
when it existed. I don't know what can happen going forward, but that was fascinating to witness how powerful that can be to have articulated principles that everybody agrees to, in addition to having just certain basic rules of behavior. So that's kind of a two-tier thing. And the thing about principles is that they do bring in the spiritual. They allow for
yeah.
the spiritual influence to find expression in even secular endeavors.
Yeah, our human condition is such an onion on this planet. The more you peel back the layers, the more layers there are.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's important, I think, to remember that on this world, progress comes even more slowly than it does on other planets. On, you know, we have to fight that much harder for fairness, for, you know, for mm-hmm. the all of the things that we want to see happen on this world, you know. And
yeah,
my hope personally always is, because I so truly believe that we are all God's children, and I so truly know what the Urantia book teaches, and I knew this before I ever read it, that that God loves us all, and that, you know, our challenge has always been whether or not we love each other. And I strive in my own life to treat God's children with the dignity that I think they deserve to be treated with. And that's everybody. And, you know, I know that there are human beings on the world that, you know, maybe live at the level of an animal, and they would devour you and not give it a second thought about how kind or loving or good you are. You know, I know that. That's a reality that we deal with, right? And I think about all the the wonderful things Jesus said, you know, to Gannett about defending himself, and how, at what, you know, point would he do that, and all of that. And I just mm-hmm. I see how long we how far we have to go before we have
yeah.
true fairness and true justice, and the kind that affords, you know, we hear oftentimes this idea of human rights and human rights violation, and, you know, it seems like the world has agreed that there are some basic human rights, you know, so we have made some progress. You know, it's still stark to think that there's places in the world where women, half the human population, is still considered a second-class citizen and still largely held in slavery. But there's another quote I want to share, and this is from paper 54. And, of course, this is about the Lucifer Rebellion, 54:1-8. It says, there is no error greater than that species of self-deception which leads intelligent beings to crave the exercise of power over other beings for the purpose of depriving these persons of their natural liberties. The golden rule of human fairness cries out against all such fraud, unfairness, selfishness, and unrighteousness. Only true and genuine liberty is compatible with the reign of love and the ministry of mercy. So, you know, they tell us in so many ways. It's almost like they keep saying it over and over again. Be good to one another. Be kind. Be just. Be fair. Be merciful. Restore the dignity of humanity. You know?
So, yeah. So how would you articulate that as a principle? I mean, not to put you on the spot, but I mean,
no.
What you're saying. I mean, it's interesting that that a conversation you referred to about Jesus talking about self-defense, you know, where would it cross the line? How would he respond to, you know, if he perceived that someone was a child of God, he would be respond differently than someone who maybe
right.
he didn't.
And he
so
said that.
He was articulating he was articulating principles there.
Yes.
Which are distinct from rules. And I think we can, you know, take some guidance from that. I mean, obviously we're not Jesus, but that idea of taking what we perceive spiritually as the right path or as a direction for growth or some kind of more like a riverbed, right? You know, a channel or a container for experience going forward that doesn't predefine outcomes, but it does condition the motivations going forward in a way that can be shared with others. So that there can be an agreement about principles as well as an agreement to follow the rules. So all of what you were saying there, Paul, was beautiful. And it could, if there's a way, I mean, something maybe we could all think about or I think about, whatever, you know, this idea of loving each other and understanding that we're all children of God and we need to keep that in mind. And when whatever we do for or with each other is also, in a sense, being done for and with God. And maybe there's a way to articulate that as a principle that people could understand or say, yeah, that makes sense or whatever, you know, and condition behavior into a more positive and spiritual direction without it being rules-based. I mean, it's like culture and civilization has its underpinning of like the Ten Commandments or whatever, you know, or the laws of Dalmatia even going all the way back.
The golden rule, as I just quoted, you know, the golden rule of human fairness. I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
To me, that is at the heart of it. I mean, and it kind of flips it back around on us and says, okay, so you want to think of things selfishly. Here's one. Think of it this way. You wouldn't like it if it was done to you.
Uh-huh.
So why would you do that to anyone else? It's just so basic. It's almost too basic. You know, if you can't justify treating people well because you wouldn't want to be treated poorly yourself, I don't know what else you could say to somebody to convince them that maybe it's better to be kind than to be cruel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an interesting... Because where does selfishness, and you go back to unmitigated selfishness and unbridled self-liberty.
Right.
It's mitigated by something. You got to mitigate selfishness somehow to say, okay, maybe I should pull back here because I wouldn't like that. You know.
That's part of it.
How else can you mitigate selfishness? You know, there you go. I mean,
the relationship between the part and the whole, and you know the book says a lot about
that. True.
Is that the individual is carried forward by the good of the whole. So that's another level of motivation to pay attention to that.
Well, true. And there's another principle.
It'll be a personal benefit if the whole is doing well, right?
Right.
Whereas if you're just acting selfishly and you don't care about the good of the whole, then you're eventually going to, destroy your nest. You know?
That's another great reason to do and to do right.
Your space is going to get smaller and smaller.
One that we don't understand so fully, Chuck. I think as a race of beings on a planet, we don't understand that. The good, you know, the part in the whole, the good done, the good of each man augments the good of all men.
Right, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
If we do good, you know, it may not necessarily personally serve us in some great and grandiose way, but it will serve the good in a collective way that will make life mm-hmm. that much better for everybody because we've done good. You know, and I,
yeah,
and that's a principle,
right.
I think. You know, and I think, you know, you say, what would my
mm-hmm.
principle be? Well, it would be, I would say it's a personal philosophy, and I can't make everybody have a personal philosophy that way, but they can work on, you know, that themselves. And we can agree on principles, you know. I mean, we obviously, many religionists agree on the golden rule, and they have all
mm-hmm.
the versions of it, but they really are saying the same thing. And, yeah, progress
yeah.
comes slowly, but, you know, I know we're getting there. And I just want to say I celebrate that with Juneteenth today because it feels like progress to me.
Yeah.
It does. You know, it
yeah.
feels good
yeah.
and positive. And
if
I'm happy.
I could just cap that off with a couple lines here from the real nature of religion that I think are
sure.
relevant to what you're saying. This is paper 101, section 7, starting just toward the end of the second paragraph, where they say that moral cowards never achieve high planes of philosophic thinking. It's kind of what you're talking about. You know, you're encouraging a higher plane of philosophic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It requires courage to invade new levels of experience and to attempt the exploration of unknown realms of intellectual living. So this is where sound principles can take us into this, you know, these exciting directions of development. And they say,
right.
presently, new systems of values come into existence. Systems of values. So think about systems of values as they apply to slavery or how that's framed, you know, in cultural thinking. Presently, new systems of values come into existence. New formulations of principles and standards are achieved. Habits and ideals are reshaped. Some idea of a personal God is attained, followed by enlarging concepts of relationship there, too. But what really stood out for me there is this idea of the relationship between the formulation of principles and the achievement of standards that are founded on the reshaping of habits and ideals. And that's, you know, what we're all trying to do, I think, every day in our lives is, you know, little by little
right.
to progress in those directions. But
yeah.
I like how they articulate that, particularly this idea of the relationship between standards and principles. In a way, they're very similar. You know, you can think of the golden rule as a standard for behavior. But you can also think of it as a principle for behavior. And it, there's an interesting dynamic between those two ways of thinking about it, which can eventually lead to new habits and the grasp,
yeah.
you know, the understanding. Yeah. Understanding new ideals, right?
So one more quote.
Yeah.
One more quote then, because
okay.
all of this
okay.
leads to, yeah, it all, I think, you know, you're right on, Chuck, and it all leads to a practice that you can do every day, a principle that you can put
uh-huh.
into practice every day of your life, you know, as an individual.
Right.
You may not get the, you know, whole of humanity to ever do that, but if each person takes it upon themselves to do something every day, more
mm-hmm.
positive than they did the day before, then things will,
mm-hmm.
you know, we will make progress. And that's a good thing. And this is, of course, you guys all know. Marvin, are you still with us? I guess Marvin might be on mute. Andre is listening.
I'm just listening.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Andre is with his family, so he's listening, but he won't be able to participate as much. He'll jump in if he can, I'm sure. This is from paper 104-6, and I know all of our listeners will know this one so well. But this is going to the principle you're talking about, Chuck. You cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Love is only born of a thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbor's motives, and sentiments. It is not so important to love all men today as it is that each day you learn to love one more human being. If each day or each week you can achieve an understanding of one more of your fellows, and if this is the limit of your ability, then you are certainly socializing and truly spiritualizing your personality. Love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate. But only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. If each mortal could only become a focus of dynamic affection, this benign virus of love would soon pervade the sentimental emotion stream of humanity to such an extent that all civilization would be encompassed by love. And that would be the realization of the brotherhood of man.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there's several principles in there, I think.
Yes, there are.
Right. Yeah,
and it's something that can be practiced. They're not saying, "Look, you got to love the love of humanity."
That's the thing about principles.
Yeah,
I know. They're practical. They can be lived out.
Yeah.
So like the sentimental idea of like, "Well, I'm just going to love everybody." You know what I mean? That really doesn't go anywhere, because once you get down to cases, you know, all your instinctive reactions and everything else. I mean, you just kind of very easily get taken over. But that opening line of what we read about love, what did it say? It's not an act of will, but it must be born of thoroughgoing understanding, something like that.
Right. And which takes effort.
Yeah.
Truly, it takes effort to know a person. You have to listen quite a lot to understand what their motives and sentiments. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a very important principle about the nature of love that
mm-hmm.
I think is often misunderstood.
I agree.
We have this idea that we can just decide to love everybody. But that doesn't work that way.
No.
I mean,
and
you can
have an attitude of love. Right.
Yeah. You can decide to be friendly, but you can't decide to love. You have to. Love has to kind of almost be earned. It has to be achieved. It has to be established or found through actually knowing the other person.
And I like that part that says, you know, a focus of dynamic affection. Because the dynamic part of it is the fact that you have proactively decided now that you're going to try to get to know more people and fall in love with them, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and
so that's the path forward. So you can see how that principle creates that path.
Right. So that is a loving attitude that you know, you want to get to know somebody. You're going to make the effort.
Right.
And I think it would be, it's almost too big of a bill to do it each day.
Yeah, if that's all you can do, it's like, what? How about one a week or one a month, you know?
And even that, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway.
Or just loving the people more than you already know.
Right.
That's
forgiving them. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
My old friend Mary used to say, well, that's all well and good, but what about the people you get to know and you think, oh, my God, I can't stand this person?
I didn't know quite so much about that person.
It's like, that's a different problem, Mary. We used to have, we worked together at Jesusonian for years, and we had great conversations, and she has a great sense of humor, and so we used to get a good chuckle. Yeah. She always made me laugh. And so,
but there are different levels of knowing too.
Yeah,
of knowing
true.
Another person. So, you know, sort of superficial level, sort of the middle level, or maybe feel like you're knowing too much. But then, underneath all of that, which is I think more what the book is talking about, are these deeper motivations. You know, where most people get down far enough into what's really motivating them, you'll find a yearning for goodness and truth and beauty and all that.
Absolutely. That's my experience. that most people are truly good people. They want to do the right thing.
Right.
You
yeah,
know?
I think so too.
Yeah. Yeah, they and they have basic human needs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm struck by just how young we are, how early we are in this whole process. And you know, so like you were saying, what you guys were talking about, that some people are harder to love. I mean, we're more and less mature, and all mm-hmm. of us have qualities that make it a little bit challenging for us to be loved. Because we're so young, we're so immature, we're so much at the beginning of this whole process, and sort of related to the. I think we're still on the paper on Ascended Destinies, are we? Or, I think.
Yeah, we're on
yeah.
section six, the Face Sons of God. So that's us.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just like, you know, we're just being formed here. And part of what I was thinking a lot about while you guys were talking was that this is the place of the embryonic formation of our souls. You know, this is where character or soul is being initiated. And all of these circumstances we're in the middle of, including slavery, are part of the challenges and difficult people to love. These are all things we struggle with and we grapple with, and sometimes we make progress and we do it well and successfully, and sometimes we fall short, and I think it's important we keep trying. And that the nature of the endeavor here is not to attain perfection in this first life in this world, because for the vast majority of us, if not all of us, that's an impossibility. It's to begin the process and make some progress and to initiate this experience of character development and soul growth embryonically, and to pick it up and move it forward in these ascended destinies, these eternal pathways that God has made for us going forward. So I always come back to that, as it's important for us to be patient with ourselves, you know, in this
yeah.
effort
so
to keep
true.
On making progress, to fight the good faith, and when we succeed, celebrate, and when we fall a little short, and get up and keep trying. and that's to me very characteristic of the loving process, you know. It's
right.
just like we have the ideal, we have the principle, as you've mentioned, Chuck, and
right.
we stretch for it, we reach for it, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes it's a little bit three steps forward, two steps back, but that we're engaged in the effort is what this is all about here in this initial life, and in the effort of growing a better world. And so I think it is significant that the legislation was passed, and we're recognizing this was a stage, and it was a primitive and earlier stage, and we are still struggling with the legacies of it, of slavery, and we need to keep moving forward, you know, three steps forward, two steps back. We need to just keep moving forward societally and spiritually and in this effort. That's what we're here to do. So
yeah.
let's
Hey, listen, I think Andre dropped off, and I'm getting this message again, so I'm going to let you guys keep talking. I'm going to hang up and try to call back in as host, okay? So keep going,
okay.
And I'll be right back.
We could start the reading, maybe.
Okay,
yeah,
why don't you
do
that?
Are we in the face Sons of God? Is that
yes.
where
yeah.
we are?
We're face Sons of God. Yep.
Yeah. Do you feel like reading, Marvin?
Yeah, I can, if you'd like.
Okay, great.
Oh, did you
I'll
say
be right
you wanted
back,
to,
guys.
Chuck? Yeah, okay, Paul.
Yeah,
I'll see you soon. Hear you soon. Okay.
Yeah, we can take it.
The Faith Sons of God. Let's just see how... Oh, that's a fairly short section. The mortal races stand as the representatives of the lowest order of intelligent and personal creation. That's sort of reflective of what I was just trying to touch on. Here we are at the bottom.
Is that what we were just talking about?
yeah. You mortals are divinely beloved, and every one of you may choose to accept the certain destiny of a glorious experience. But you are not yet by nature of the divine order. You are wholly mortal. You will be reckoned as ascending sons the instant fusion takes place. But the status of the mortals of time and space is that of faith sons prior to the event of the final amalgamation of the surviving mortal soul with some type of eternal and immortal spirit. So they're talking about fusion here. So we're, I guess we're faith sons. We're accomplished sons, or sons of sort of certainty in a sense, sons and daughters. I guess we'll read more about this. But this is an interesting point. It would be good for us to come back to it, I think.
I think so,
hold that thought. I'm back, buddy.
Yeah, hold that thought.
Great. It is a
solemn and supernal fact that such lowly and material creatures as Urantia human beings are the sons of God, faith children of the highest. Quote, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. As many as received him, to them gave he the power to recognize that they are the sons of God. While it does not yet appear what you shall be, even now you are the faith sons of God. For you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you have received the spirit of sonship, whereby you cry, Our Father, spoke the prophet of old in the name of the eternal God. Even to them will I give in my house a place and a name better than sons. I will give them an everlasting name, one that shall not be cut off. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the spirit of his sons, of his son, into your hearts. So that was all a series of passages, scriptural passages.
Yeah. Woven together masterfully.
All evolutionary worlds of mortal habitation harbor these faith sons of God, sons of grace and mercy, mortal beings belonging to the divine family, and accordingly called the sons of God. Urantia mortals are entitled to regard themselves as being the sons of God because, and then there's a list of five elements. One, you are sons of spiritual promise, faith sons. You have accepted the status of sonship. You believe in the reality of your sonship. And thus does your sonship with God become eternally real. Two, this is two in the list of why we are sons of God, can be called sons of God. Two, a creator son of God became one of you. He is your elder brother in fact. And if in spirit you become truly related brothers of Christ, the victorious Michael, then in spirit must you also be sons of that Father which you have in common, even the universal Father of all. Three, you are sons because the spirit of a son has been poured out upon you, has been freely and certainly bestowed upon all Urantia races. This spirit ever draws you toward the divine Son who is its source, and toward the Paradise Father who is the source of that divine Son. Four, of his divine free willness, the Universal Father has given you your creature personalities. You have been endowed with a measure of that divine spontaneity of free will action which God shares with all who may become his sons. Five, there dwells within you a fragment of the Universal Father, and you are thus directly related to the divine Father of all the sons of God.
Those five things are so powerful.
They are.
You know, it's a they're establishing for us all the reasons why. You know, in the conversation we had, and I'm glad we had that conversation because it fits so well with this section. All the reasons why we should show love and respect and give dignity and honor to our fellow beings. You know?
You know, I wanna just go briefly sort of summarize that list of five, and just want to make an observation. The list of five, in a word or two, and go from the bottom up. So there are these five reasons why we can be considered a son. You know, and the son is basically a created being of the Father, and we're men and women, we're sons and daughters in certain senses. But we're in the category of the sons of God as the created beings of God, the children of God, in a sense. And there are these five reasons. One is that God has placed a fragment of himself in us. Two is that God made each of us as a person, out of his own person. Three, because the Spirit of Truth is with us. Jesus is with us as a son and as a brother. And four, that Jesus became one of us. He became a son of God down at our level. And then the first one that they state at the beginning is really interesting to me, and that is that it's our faith that accepts all of these things, that makes us faith sons, right? So that I accept that Jesus came to live as, and that he was a divine being, and that his Spirit is with me, and that the Father has made me as a person, and that the Father indwells me, that I accept all these things, and I kind of work with them in my life as givens. I believe them, and I try to live them, makes me operatively a faith child of God, a faith son of God. What's interesting to me in the beginning of this section, that we are not yet by nature of the divine order. You are mortal. You will be reckoned as ascending sons the instant fusion takes place. But our status now is faith sons. And so there's this distinction, and I think it's an important one, that when we fuse, our sonship status and our destiny is guaranteed, absolutely. Nothing will ever stop it. We have made the decision. We have fused with the fragment of God, and we will go forward eternally. And it's a done deal. It's all a done deal, and we have to actualize it into eternity. But there's nothing iffy or perhaps temporary about our status as children of God when we fuse. From now up until we fuse, we're faith sons and daughters. So we have to accept and function with these things, and that will hold us up to the point of the maturing of our decisions and our faith to the point we fuse, and then we're permanent citizens, permanent sons of God. So it's a really important section, I think.
Yeah, attention to the first one, because there's something in there that I think is very interesting, which has to do with the whole relationship between faith and belief that, you know, we all maybe struggle with to some extent. It always comes up in religious discussions and whatnot. But in this sentence, even though they're referring to us as faith sons, what establishes that for us is that we believe in the reality of our sonship. In other words, that second sentence doesn't say you have faith in the reality of your sonship. It says you believe in the reality of your sonship, and thus does your sonship with God become eternally real. So that's an interesting moment there where they point to the importance of belief in addition to faith. That there's, and we know that they're related in close and interesting ways, and distinctions can be made, of course, between faith and belief, very important distinctions. But in this sentence, they're pointing to belief, which I don't know.
That's interesting, Chuck. It comes first.
Solid, yeah,
belief comes first.
Right.
Belief comes before faith. I think because they tell us in other places that you go from a believer to a faither, you know.
Faith is more dynamic. I mean, faith is like, okay, that's like stepping off the cliff. Knowing that their hands underneath will catch you, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, which is not as, I don't know. It's like the wind in the sails and all those analogies and metaphors. But belief is just like a rock. Okay, I'm going to believe this and see what happens. And this particular belief is the origin of our progress as sons and daughters of God going forward into eternity. So it's interesting that it all starts from there, kind of. That's like the first step, like you're saying, Paula.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about the distinction between, this is subtle stuff, and I try to grab hold of what's the difference between something I believe and something I have faith in. For me, I think it's reflected in numerous sections in the text. I think there is one on faith and belief in the religion papers, which is unpacks this. But for me, the easy way I hold on to it is a belief is almost it's a step above a fact. It's an intellectual reality that I accept. It's a premise or a principle that I can intellectually hold in my mind. Right. I believe that God made me. Right. Made my person. That's an intellectual, almost a fact. Right. It's a profound fact, but it's a statement that I can make almost as a doctrinal statement. The difference between my believing that reality and my having faith in it is the difference between a thought and a living experience for me. Taking the fact and living it out in that relationship with God, you know, as my days unfold in my relationships with others and in my interior life, that's having faith in it. That's living it out. And what happens is I become that reality. I don't just understand it. I have become it experientially and functionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always, that understanding is that, you know, they make the statement, that you can, faith is something that must be lived in order to become real. So, you know, and they say over and over that the power of Jesus' life was that it was a whole life. It's the whole way he lived, his relationships, the incidents in his life, the experiences, the stories of his embodiment of these principles that gave them so much power. And so that's helpful for me is belief is necessary, absolutely necessary, because unless we understand it, we can't live it out. But it's only the first step to living it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right. It's like where they say that our thoughts lead us Godward.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not saying that our thoughts are God, right?
Right.
It's like our thoughts take us to the threshold of having a living relationship with God, and that's what faith, that's where, you know, that faith fuels the reality of that experience. But we need to get to the gateway
and
our beliefs, our thoughts and beliefs bring us to the gateway, but then we have to step across, we have to open the door, so to speak.
Jesus said that too,
right? He sure did.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. It's like an invitation. Like, hey, come on, let's get together. Let's do something together. And that's a faith.
It's just almost like it's a level of consecration, and the difference between belief and faith. You know, you can say you believe it, but if you're not living it, you really don't have faith in it, right? If you're living it, then you have faith in it that it will work out for the best for all involved. And back to principles, but here's from paper 102. We've mentioned it a couple times, and this is the one place in the whole book that the word faithers shows up. But it says belief. This is 102.67. Belief may not be able to resist doubt and withstand fear, but faith is always triumphant over doubting. For faith is both positive and living. The positive always has the advantage over the negative, truth over error, experience over theory, spiritual realities over the isolated facts of time and space. The convincing evidence of this spiritual certainty consists in the social fruits of the spirit which such believers, faithers, yield as a result of this genuine spiritual experience. Said Jesus, if you love your fellows as I have loved you, then shall all men know that you are my disciples. So that's, you know, it's interesting. It starts with belief, but belief may not be able to resist doubt and withstand fear, but faith is always triumphant over doubting. So, yeah.
Here's one I can't remember the context. I think it was yesterday, and this passage came to mind. It was in another discussion, another conversation, or the day before. But it's been in my thinking recently, and it does relate to the conversation about the difference between knowledge and faith, or belief and faith. And this is a very interesting statement. It's 193.04. It's one of the pretty sure it's one of the resurrection appearances. And this is what Jesus says. He says, and pay attention to the difference in how the words know and faith or experience are used in this passage.
Okay.
That which the world needs most to know, and knowing is a belief, right? It's an intellectual reality, is men are the sons of God. And through faith, they can actually realize and daily experience this ennobling truth. So, and then he goes on to say, my bestowal should help all men to know that they are the children of God, but such knowledge will not suffice if they fail personally to faith grasp the saving truth that they are the living spirit sons of the eternal Father. The gospel of the kingdom is concerned with the love of the Father and the service of his children on earth. So you look at the distinction he's making between simply apprehending something with your mind, to know it, and going the critical next step, and the words he's using, they can actually realize, which is to make something real, in one sense of that, and daily experience, actually experience this truth. And he uses the word truth always in association with experience and living, and the truth is a step substantially above simple knowledge or belief. It's always alive. It's lived out.
Right.
And he says such knowledge will not suffice. Yeah, such knowledge will not suffice. Knowledge alone, if they fail personally to faith grasp the saving truth that you are the living spirit sons of the eternal Father. So it's just that he's emphasizing something here, you know, that I think is very, very important about the relationship between belief, which is critical, because if you believe the wrong things, you live out the wrong things, right? So you have to have the right, you have to have the right beliefs. But then you actually, to faith grasp them is to live them. Day in, day out in endless experiential situations. And that's been really helpful for me. And what it really connects to for me is that the gospel is, we've talked about this many, many times here on the show, the gospel is essentially relational. It's a set of relationships between persons, right? Between us and the founding, the originating person. It's a living relationship we have with the Creator, our spiritual parent, our father and mother, and it unfolds day in, day out. We live within it, and it's a set of relationships we have with each other that flow from that primary relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that functions is to be alive in experience. So this is, I think it's critically important when Jesus said that he came to show a new kind of religion. It's a religion mm-hmm. that can't be simply talked about. It's a religion that gets lived.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in that sense, Jesus was and is a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this book is a revelation, but Jesus is also a revelation. And there's paragraphs that I think echo what you're saying, Marvin, in a really interesting way from the paper 101, The Real Nature of Religion. Maybe I could just read those because they kind of map
our
the sequence of our progress through these stages. I'll just read the last two paragraphs of Section 5 in that paper. So it's paragraph 13. It says, evolutionary religion provides only the assurance of faith and the confirmation of conscience. Revelatory religion, so now we're talking about Jesus and the real revelation of deity. Revelatory religion provides the assurance of faith plus the truth of a living experience in the reality of revelation. The third step in religion, or the third phase of the experience of religion, has to do with the Maranja state, the firmer grasp of motive. Increasingly, in the Maranja progression, the truths of revealed religion are expanded. More and more, you will know the truth of supreme values, divine goodnesses, universal relationships, eternal realities, and ultimate destinies. Increasingly, throughout the Maranja progression, the assurance of truth replaces the assurance of faith. When you are finally mustered into the actual spirit world, what a day that'll be, then will the assurances of pure spirit insight operate in the place of faith and truth, or rather in conjunction with and superimposed upon these former techniques of personality assurance.
Wow.
That's a great
section. So we can.
Yeah, that's a great
section.
Yeah. So that idea of personality assurance, you know, we can kind of anticipate almost in our present state the importance of faith because it's, and revelation, because it's moving us in this direction that, you know, we can look forward to progress in this, you know, through these stages of development. But that startled me when the first time I read that. You know, in a way, you know, we progress from faith to truth.
Yeah,
and from
that's
truth
the part
to,
of
like,
it that's,
truth,
wow.
Truth, yeah, true spirit experience. But key in that, in our stage, is this whole thing about revelation,
mm-hmm.
how it provides a living experience in the reality, a living experience in the realities of revelation, which is different from a purely evolutionary, just sort of spirit of worship and grasp. There must be something more, you know. So I'll just proceed on faith, but there must be. But Jesus, when you meet Jesus or, you know, get a sense of his spirit, that's a reality that actually has an influence in our lives.
Yeah.
Which, you know, takes
so
us to another level. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, the statement where they say what the world needs now is to see Jesus living again in the spirit-born lives of men, modern men and women. You know, I mean, and the message there is again, it's lives that are lived that are powerful. Jesus' life is a powerful experience for us. And as he lives again in us and as the Father lives and we live this relationship with the Father and God as Mother as well, and we're nourished and nurtured and we live differently and we live in relationship with each other differently, then Jesus is he's expressing himself anew in our lives, you know. So and this connection it really is fascinating. I think Maranja reality is living reality. And that's why it's a soul reality. It's not just something we understand with the mind. It's really interesting that in the next life, in the Maranja life, starting the mansion worlds, the center of our person is the soul. You know, that's where our will resides, that where we make decisions and we move forward. And the mind is in a sense, I don't mean to minimize it at all, but it's a peripheral set of tools that is crucial because it's still what we understand with. But I think what happens in the next life is we come to a much fuller understanding that Maranja reality is lived reality, not simply understood reality.
Right.
Moda comes in. Yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah, Moda. And the passage you read is like right on target, you know. It's just a great passage.
Mm-hmm. I have to point out a couple of really great comments that have just been made on the board. First of all, Diane said, she said, that's why they tell us that our thought adjusters are pre-personal, because they need the personal religious experience, which is so true. And then Robert, and I love this, Robert, this is excellent. Robert says, the difference between belief and faith. Imagine sitting in a circus tent, 30 feet above is a tightrope walker with a wheelbarrow and no net below. The tightrope walker begins to push the wheelbarrow along the rope above. It's easy to sit in your seat and believe he will make it to the other side without falling. But if you have faith, you'll get in the wheelbarrow. I love that. That is so, you know, if you have real faith, you'll get in the wheelbarrow. Not to say that you should do anything foolhardy because you have faith. I don't think that's the point. But the point is that faith does call you to action, to step out.
Yeah. Well, and also
courage, as we said earlier, you know.
Yeah. Right.
To have that courage.
Yeah, there is an interesting relationship between faith and the willingness to take risk.
Yes, that's true.
You know, knowing that you're not alone, that your endeavors in this world, we're in partnership with God. That makes a huge difference in terms of being willing just to take risk. Maybe not getting in the wheelbarrow, but the wheelbarrow.
And maybe you will.
You know, sometimes.
And maybe it would cost you your life. Right, but if you have faith in a principle, let's say like liberty, then would you put on a uniform and go fight so that, you know, against the hostility that might take that liberty away from you or from your family? Yes, you would. It happens all the time. Our forefathers all probably engaged in such things to one degree or another. And, you know, so that's to have faith in an idea, a principle. Can be a good and wonderful thing to cause you to step out of your comfort zone to achieve something. And Guard, our friend Guard, has a story. And Marvin, he's probably told you this a dozen times about the monks that went down to the field of battle and just quietly walked up and down in front of the two warring factions until they put their weapons down. And went away, you know. And so the monks put themselves in harm's way in order to peacefully resolve a conflict that would have ended in bloodshed. And they did so just by putting their bodies in between two warring factions. And you wouldn't think, and that's a true story, and you wouldn't think that that would happen, but sometimes, you know, the reality of a good person who is willing to sacrifice themselves for a principle that they believe is greater than themselves is shocking enough to get you to stop doing what you're doing. And
or
rethink.
To do something that,
Yeah.
You know, a huge faith decision, the decision to have children, if you think about that.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that so true?
To decide, okay, let's do this. Let's try and make a family. Let's try and have children.
This is a lifelong commitment.
Talk about a faith adventure or a faith commitment. Yeah. Yeah, no idea.
That's why
happen.
Every time a young couple decides to do that.
Yeah.
And it's frightening. especially in this world.
And I've certainly known many couples who decided not to do that.
I have
too. Yeah, they just decline to go into such a realm. They'd rather just have fun and travel and enjoy themselves.
Yeah, not have the responsibility or the awesome
right.
responsibility. Which, don't you think that's why we celebrate when babies so much? It's the best
uh-huh.
ever when a young, loving couple gets married. And it's even better when they have a child, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mazel tov, Angie and Vipin. God bless you. Yeah, that takes a lot of courage. God bless you. I just want to celebrate that, you know. When young people decide
mm-hmm.
to get married and have a family, I think that's
yeah.
just remarkable. And especially when they are as remarkable as Andy and Vipin are. That's Chuck's daughter and son-in-law, by the way, friends, if you didn't know that. And they just had a baby boy, Orion. It was such a thing to celebrate, new life coming into the world, especially to a loving family. When you know that child's
mm-hmm.
going to be nurtured and loved and treasured, and yeah, that's
well,
special.
The new son of God too.
Yeah, new son of
well,
God.
You know, I think part of what's interesting, you know, you look at that as a faith step, and you look at what unfolds from it, what flows from it. It's basically 20 years of life. You know, 20 years of
at
parenting.
Least.
At
yeah.
least. Yeah, and it goes on, you know, but I mean, a solid day in, day out, 16, 17, 18 years. And talk about a life lived that changes you, that makes you different after that experience than you ever were before. And they say that experience, that transformative faith experience is so necessary that everyone will experience it either in this life or in the next life.
Right.
Even if you haven't had that experience here on the early mansion
you'll
worlds,
get it.
You'll probably have 15, 20 years minimum, I think, of that kind of devotion and living out
yeah.
the devotion that the Father has for us
right.
so that we experientially get it. We have become it on some level. And that happens at the earliest stage of our ascent. You know, it's almost like we can't take any further steps until we've
mm-hmm.
internalized that experience of what that kind of devotion is. Because we don't really, until we've had that, we don't really clearly understand experientially what God is doing for us and will continue
exactly,
to do for us
yeah.
eternally. Yeah,
it's like basic
yeah.
training.
Yeah, but it's you know, we take the step, we call it taking the step in faith, but the faith step is the 17 or 18 years of devotion and doing it,
right,
living it out,
right.
that changes our nature. It just, we're
yeah.
just different on the other side of it. And I don't know that I could describe some facets of how that's changed me, but you know, it's so subtle, but I think
mm-hmm.
it's... they say it's critical to an understanding of what the gods have made and what their plan is for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's a great quote.
Cool. Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't want to stop your thought, Chuck. Go ahead. I'll
no,
I
just say it would be cool to actually have that experience on the Mansion World to be like the adoptive parent or the parent of adopted children. Coming
well,
from
it would be. It
would
be delightfully wonderful to be able to do that without all the fears that come with doing it on this world, right?
Yeah.
Because there is no love like parental love. I mean, it just throttles you. It goes through and through you again, you know. It's an amazing experience. But this is from paper 84, section 7, paragraph 26. It says, civilization regards parents as assuming all duties. The child is having all the rights. Respect of the child for his parents arises not in knowledge of the obligation implied in parental procreation, but naturally grows as a result of the care, training, and affection which are lovingly displayed in assisting the child to win the battles of life. The true parent is engaged in a continuous service ministry, which the wise child comes to recognize and appreciate. And I personally think that that service ministry is lifelong. You know, they become independent and self-reliant and able to solve all of their problems, and they don't need your help. But your help is always there, ever ready. That's the service ministry of it. Your help is continuous. It doesn't end.
Particularly
the wise child. Yeah. The wise child comes to recognize and appreciate that. And, you know, I find that that happens when they become adults and have children of their own. But anyway, that was a nice little diversion, you guys, because, you know, it takes tremendous faith to have a child in this world. I agree. That's such a good point. I want to point out too something that intrigued me, and this is about free will, because they do mention that. It's in number 4, of His divine free willness, the Universal Father has given you your creature personalities. You have been endowed with a measure of that divine spontaneity of free will action, which God shares with all who may become His sons. So, Marvin, I think you summed it up by saying, you know, you've been given a personality, and that makes you a son. Yeah, and there's another part to that, though.
Mm-hmm.
You've been given a measure of divine spontaneity of free will action. And that free willness also makes you a son of God. And I wanted to point out there is one place in the book that they tell us about mind of will dignity and what a big deal it is. And that's in the history papers where Andon and Fonta show up with mind of will dignity. And the life carriers that have been watching over the planet have been waiting for this to happen. It's a big deal. And this is the quote. This is from paper 6273. To the life carriers on Urantia, greetings. We transmit assurance of great pleasure on Salvington and Dentia and Jerusalem and honor the registration on the headquarters of Nebadon of the signal of the existence on Urantia of mind of will dignity. The purposeful decision of the twins to flee northward and segregate their offspring from their inferior ancestors has been noted. This is the first decision of mind, the human type of mind, on Urantia, and automatically establishes the circuit of communication over which this initial message of acknowledgement is transmitting. I'm so intrigued by free will and how they wait for it to show up and how obvious it is to them. And you know, we were talking about, Marvin read the list backwards. So apropos, because that's one of the first things that has to happen. Mind of will dignity has to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, well, there's such an interesting phrase in that point number 4 that you're kind of pointing to, Paul. just consider this combination of 4 or 5 words. Divine spontaneity of free will action.
Yeah.
So they're not just saying a measure of spontaneous free will action. You know what I mean? It's just like all over the place. They're talking about a measure of divine spontaneity of free will action. In other words, we have this capacity with our power of will to act spontaneously in a way that
is divine,
characterized by divinity. I mean, what a thing that is, to not just, you know, have the capacity for spontaneity of free will, but to have the capacity for divine spontaneity of free will.
Right.
Which takes it to a whole nother level. In other words, it's like God is in there. Anytime you talk about something being divine, right, there's a, you know, a unity with the cosmos. There's a expression of divine nature. So that we have the capacity to express divine nature to any degree at all is pretty remarkable. but they're saying that that can just happen spontaneously through this endowment that they're talking about. You know, the endowment of personality from the Father. If we're, you know, exercise that and cultivate it and develop it, you know, along spiritual lines, then we have this capacity for divine spontaneity, free will action, which I think is just, I don't know, takes away that feeling of being paralyzed by indecision. It's like, okay, I want to do God's will, but I don't know what it is, so I'm just going to sit here and worry about it, you know, and not actually do anything.
Exactly. Yeah. The dead level of indecision.
I don't want to get it wrong, right? You know what I mean? I don't want to screw up. I don't want to do it wrong. So I'm just going to sit here and not do anything. Sort of like just burying your talents, you know.
Right.
Metaphor for that.
And again, about taking a risk. There it is again.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Because you don't always know exactly what the right thing to do is, but you have to do something.
Yeah.
And if you use that divine spontaneity,
yeah.
Right, which to me connotes morality. You know, to make the moral decision.
Well, it frames our morality, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right, informs it. There's something else I wanted to point out here that I think is interesting. I'm sure you all noticed, but in that long paragraph with all the quoted statements from the different scriptures,
I don't even
know where they all come from. But one of them, they say, "I will give them an everlasting name, one that shall not be cut off." And what an interesting thing, because that's the same thing we learn in the Urantia book about fusion, and we, you know. When we get our real universe name, when we fuse with our adjusters, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what they're talking about here. Prior to that, you know, what they were saying in that earlier paragraph is, you know, we're kind of probationary or provisional, you know, our place in the universe isn't guaranteed until fusion takes place. And that's when we get our true universe name, and a name that shall not be cut off. I think that's really interesting. Way of describing that, because
do
if we
you
don't
think
use,
that they
if we reject survival, our name will be lost. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do you think that they give us quotes like this? I mean, I've often thought this, just to show us that these are not concepts that haven't been spoken to us before.
Yeah.
That you already knew this, kids. You've already been told this in other ways, but here you go. Just so you know, this isn't new, what we've told you in this revelation. We're just reiterating, in many instances, what you already knew but forgot or didn't pay attention to or didn't understand, you know? So that's one of the beauties of revelation. It gives you that back and says, oh, here's the missing piece. You didn't understand what that meant, but here's what it means.
All right, we'll expand on this.
Yeah, let us expand on it. You're provisional. I think, Marvin, you pointed that out in the first paragraph, in which, you know, the book tells us that we should develop a long-distance viewpoint of our career, and we should start to, you know, that we could make the eternal promise now. We can make the betrothal now. We can say even now, not my will, but yours be done, you know?
Yeah.
And look forward to that never-ending life. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's earlier in the book, interestingly enough, and it's pretty easy to find, where they say that here in this life, the material life on our evolutionary worlds, the one we're living now, that survival decisions are being, and they italicize these three words. Here they're being formulated, these survival decisions. On the mansion worlds, the early mansion worlds, those survival decisions are being confirmed, and that's italicized, and, which is interesting. And then upon fusion, the survival decision has been made, which is, you know, in light of what
consecrated.
We're talking about, well, in the light, it lived out on some level, you know, in the light of what we were talking about, that it's, you know, it's one thing to apprehend something with mind. It's another thing to live it somehow, to live it out and embody it and become it. And so what they're saying is a survival decision is a done deal at that point, where you've experientially somehow realized it and made it happen, that that survival is guaranteed at that point upon fusion. And fusion sort of signalizes the having been made of the survival decision. So that's just really interesting. But the really what's going on down here is we're formulating those decisions. We're coming to an understanding of what they are and dedicating ourselves to the attempt to live them out, I think. And it's on the mansion worlds that they're being confirmed. You know, we're living them out and actualizing them and taking the forward steps and doing the parenting if we haven't and forming the relationship so that by the time we fuse, we've been transformed at that point. And so survival is then an accomplished reality that cannot be taken away from us on some level. So those three words are really interesting. Yeah.
The, maybe I'd also like to just underline this one statement that's always been one of my favorites, where they say, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God." And you can say sons and daughters of God, if you like. It's, but that idea that, wow, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, you know, that we should be called his children. That just says so much in such a beautiful and brief way. You know, behold.
Where is that, Chuck?
That's in paragraph two. It's the first quoted.
Oh, in the okay.
Yeah, in paragraph
and Marvin,
two. Section.
Paragraph two, okay. Right. And, oh, yes, I see it. Behold what manner of
What manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. The
sons of God.
You know, it's not saying that we should be called the servants of God, or that
right.
we should be called the lowly creatures who are ready to get stomped on by God.
Or
whatever.
Or even worse, the unworthy. The unworthy of God.
Yeah,
right. The original sinners under God, you know, or whatever.
Right. And then how Jesus illustrates that so beautifully in the parable of the prodigal son.
Yeah.
That, you know, it brings full expression to the meaning of that relationship that we have with the Father.
That is the heart of redemption right there. That's it.
Mm.
You know, you're redeemed from your belief that you're not worthy. Redemption is, no, this is the love I've always had for you. You walked away, but it was always here for you, and you could always come back to it. It didn't go anywhere, and it never will. It's yours by right of birth. This love belongs to you, and you are worthy of it. That's redemption. You know, I think of the beautiful scene of redemption in the story of Jean Valjean and Les Miserables, where the priest, you know, he steals the candlesticks and the police bring him back, and the priest tells him, you know, you sold your... He stands up for him to the police and says, no, I gave him those. You know, go on your way, good constable, you know. And Valjean is stunned, right? And he says, you sold your soul. but I bought it back for you. And that's the same thing. It's coming home to the realization that God's love is endless. It never changed. You were always worthy of it. You know, you only believed you weren't. And the prodigal son, you know, he makes a decision while he's in the field laboring away. Gee, my father treats his own servants much better than this fellow.
His servant, his employee.
Yeah, I'm going to go back home and work for my father.
See if I get a job.
Yeah, see if I can get a job for my father. And when he comes up, it's such a celebration. And we all as parents know how that, you know, everybody who's ever been a parent understands that feeling. So when you return to believing in the Father's love and having faith in the Father's love and goodness and mercy and generosity and you know, what joy that gives a father.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting detail in that story that somebody pointed out once. Maybe this came up in a Christian context, I don't remember exactly, but the idea of the father in that scene running to the child, it's like somebody pointed out, culturally in those days, the man never ran, that was like something you just didn't do. He didn't do, you know, he had to pull up your whatever you're wearing, you know, to clear your legs. So, I mean, it just wasn't done, right? It was awkward. It was embarrassing. It was just, you know, it's like not something that was culturally really you would ever see happen.
Or maybe not dignified. Yeah.
Not dignified. Yeah, all those kind of things. So the fact that the father ran to his child, it was a tremendous expression of like how much meaning and feeling was in that for the father, that he would forget all the normalities of behavior and just run to his son, right?
Right.
That's kind of a beautiful aspect to that story that I hadn't really appreciated until someone, you know, I heard someone talk about that.
So much depth in Jesus's parables.
I know.
They're so simple and yet so deep and so profound.
Yeah. The other thing that comes up in these, what's that?
Well, I was just going to say the returning was the realization, and the realization is the redemption. But go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was going to say in those 5 points, the only thing we haven't really talked about yet is the role of the son in this. What do they say?
That's 2 and 3, actually.
We're entitled to regard ourselves as sons and daughters of God because of, and there's 2 points about about Jesus, I think are very interesting. That particularly they say that, you know, like the spirit of Jesus, the spirit of truth, not only draws us toward him as a living human example of divinity, but through him, we're also drawn towards paradise. Father, who is the source of the Son, you know, the divine Son.
Right. Our common ancestor, right?
The chain of relationship there. That the Father not only gives us the Spirit to live within us, but he also gives us a living example of a human being who is divine. So we can know divinity through someone who is one of us. And what a gift that is. And how that experience, the opportunity to have that experience, is on this list of reasons why we're entitled to regard ourselves as, you know, sons of God. So, you know, this idea that we can know a divine version of a human being and see God in Jesus and know that that same spirit can be in us. I don't know. I think that's a cool aspect to this.
I think it's important to note, too, that in paragraph 3, they say Urantia mortals are entitled to regard themselves as being the sons of God because. So these are not exclusive, you know. Other planets that have beings who haven't had a creator son yet could still be consider themselves sons of God. But these are all the reasons why we can.
We.
Which are many.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I love that because, you know, just the way they say it, a creator son of God became one of you. He's your elder brother in fact. And if in spirit you become truly related brothers of Christ, the victorious Michael, then in spirit must you also be sons of that Father which you have in common, even
right.
the universal
right.
Father of all. Mm-hmm. You know, even more so for us that we can, and I can't help but wonder if maybe some of the Christian theology about, you know, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're not, you know, you're not going to make it. And, you know, it could stem from that they so thorough, you know, they know, they understand that he gets them there. And if you don't go through, with that, then you're not saved, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't mean you won't survive, though.
Right.
Work it out.
We know that.
Yeah, I mean,
but,
that's not something that should be held over people's heads. But it is definitely an invitation. You know, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, he told us. And, you know, that's quite a gift to offer someone.
Yeah.
You know,
and also,
relationship. Yeah.
We have the spirit of truth, and that's, you
mm-hmm.
know, it ever draws you toward the divine son. There's a spirit gravity involved in that. So, yeah.
Well, the thing
what
about
a celebration.
You know, we find the Father through Jesus. You know,
right.
He pretty much said that. You know, no one goes to the Father except through me. And that
right.
can sound like, you know, that's taken the wrong way or applied institutionally in some you know.
Yeah.
Wrong.
If you're not
a
Christian, then yeah, you're not going
to
heaven.
Right.
That's the boiled down.
So we
got to
convert everybody. We're not going to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's well meant, but I think that we have a opportunity to realize that in the next life, if we don't quite get there in this life.
Of course, yeah.
And the true meaning of those statements will then become clear
right.
so they don't sound like oppressive or like my way or the highway or something.
It goes back to what Marvin was saying about the, you know, the experience on the mansion worlds. And Marvin, I like that quote you shared with the three words in italics. Where was that? Did you mention where that was?
I actually looked it up. Yeah, it's actually 112:7-6.
Okay, I want to go and mull that one over.
it's a very interesting paragraph.
112:7-6.
Yeah, so you want to go ahead and read it?
You go ahead.
It's got some interesting details to it. So it says, on the evolutionary world, selfhood is material. It is a thing in the universe and as such is subject to the laws of material existence. It is a fact in time and responsive to the vicissitudes thereof. Survival decisions must here be formulated. In the Marantia state, the self has become a new and more enduring universe reality, and its continuing growth is predicated on its increasing attunement to the mind and spirit circuits of the universes. Survival decisions are now being confirmed. When the self attains the spiritual level, and this is open to some interpretation, it has become a secure value in the universe, and this new value is predicated on the fact that survival decisions have been made, which fact has been witnessed by eternal fusion with the thought adjuster. And having achieved the status of a true universe value, the creature becomes liberated in potential for the seeking of the highest universe value, God.
Mm.
So anyways, it's just an interesting three-stage description.
Interesting how they use the word value, the concept of value in that context.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and then the other thing that's interesting is they say when the self attains the spiritual level, which, you know, on the fifth or sixth mansion world, when we fuse, we're still at the very early stages of the Narancha life. So, you know, that's interesting how they tie it to the spiritual level.
Well, they associate it
maybe
with
they mean it more
a,
generically.
Yeah.
Becoming a secure value in the universe. Not,
yeah.
You know, they don't say that we then have secure value in the universe. They say that we become a secure value in the universe when we attain the spiritual level. And this new value is predicated on the fact of decisions. But anyway, elsewhere in the book, they talk about the distinction between things that have value and things that are value. And that distinction is, I can see that distinction playing out in this paragraph where they say in that last sentence, and having achieved the status of a true universe value, the creature becomes liberated in potential. So I just never quite thought of it in those terms before, but that we are, we're becoming a value.
Becoming a value.
Something about that. It's intriguing. They don't say, well, we become more valuable as we go along because we're more spiritual. That's not what they're saying. They're saying that we actually become a value, and that it has to be unique in each case for each of us.
And that God is
that
the highest value.
Right.
Yeah.
And we each have a unique value, and our value is reaching for God, the value of God, and that's that whole progression.
Becoming God-like.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, gosh, you guys, what a great conversation. I'm so sorry we had the trouble at the beginning of the show, but I'm glad that we worked it out. Thank you, Andre. Andre's back. And we didn't. Yeah, we were able to continue on because this is such a great paper, and the Faith Sons of God, it was a wonderful section, and I think we really covered, you know, the idea, the concepts of this section very well. And so thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed our conversation about Juneteenth, too, and about liberty. Talk about important values, right? and principles, as Chuck pointed out. So it was delightful. Thank you. And I appreciate you guys so much. And, you know, I think it's kind of neat that we can go and celebrate a brand new holiday today. And the holiday is about liberty, yet another holiday about being free. Really a good one.
Yeah. It's a very significant point in our unfolding histories in many ways.
Yeah. Progress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that celebration can someday be expanded to include anyone who's found liberation from enslavement influences or even their own bad decisions. You know what I mean? Rejoicing in liberation of all kinds.
Well, that's such a great section in the book, True and False Liberty. And so important. So, well, we'll be back next week, friends, with the last part of this. And I think we might be able to get through more than one section, but I don't know.
Oh,
Father,
we'll probably
we've got
Father, Son, and Spirit fused. Come on, we can do it.
Come on,
we're
we
up
can
to
do
it.
Okay.
Yeah, those are substantial sections,
and then
the one on ascended destinies is
really
rich. Yeah,
that will save for another day, probably. Yeah, that's a big one.
That's a good one.
But we've got at least 2 weeks out of this, anyway. Sorry not to be with you guys today, but it was nice to listen in the background for part of what we had, and look forward to being with you next week.
Yeah,
until
me too.
Then.
Look forward to having you back with us.
Yeah, thanks for all your help, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you. Have a great time with your kids.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice to be with family. Last chance for us to all be together for several months, probably.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Well, and happy
Father's
Day to everybody tomorrow.
Yes,
Father's Day. Yeah. All you fathers
out
there.
Oh, my goodness.
That's right.
To you, Marvin and Chuck, and to Glenn. You know?
Yeah.
Sure enough.
Absolutely. May it be a good day, and let's remember our Universal Father.
That's right.
You know,
every
day
is
the Universal Father's the Father's Day. I think.
Universal Grandfather.
It is to me.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah,
love
he's
right
at all of us, raising us all up.
He gave us a chance, right, to be eternal.
Yeah.
Yay.
Well, I love you.
Right.
Okay. Love you,
too.
Love
you,
too.
Until next week.
Have a great week.
Have a great week.
Okay.
You too. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.